Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Johnny Tan, author of From My Mama's Kitchen, Food for the Soul, Recipes for Living. Welcome to my weekly From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio show. My guest for this morning is Travis DiNicola. He is the executive director for the nonprofit literacy group Indie Reads. Travis and I will be discussing how his organization conducts adult and family literacy programs in central Indiana and their newly released book titled Indie Writes Books. Good morning, Travis. Welcome to From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. How are you doing this morning?
Good morning, Johnny. I'm doing great. Thank you for having me on your show.
Fantastic. It is a pleasure to have you on the air with me. Indie Writes Books is an interesting read. The book is a wonderful anthology, so congratulations for that.
Thank you very much. We're very proud of it. We think it's just a really great, fun collection. Great way to showcase Indiana authors and also raise awareness for adult literacy issues.
Fantastic. Let us start by getting to know you a little better. Please give us a quick walkthrough of your life from childhood to the present moment.
Sure, of course. So I live in Indianapolis now, but originally grew up in Pennsylvania, grew up in Erie, and then went to school at Penn State, both undergraduate and graduate school. And I really thought I was going to actually be more involved in the arts. I studied theater and dance and museum education, art education. But I really, I come from a family that has always really valued books and literacy. Both my parents worked professionally as journalists and also as English teachers. And my grandfather was also very involved in that as well. And I worked at a bookstore for a while when I was in college and graduate school. And I've always sort of been surrounded by that. And so over the years, after I finished school, I started working in the not-for-profit world, and that led me to it was not initially literacy and education as I am now, but really arts education. But that work has led me over the years to the job that I'm doing now and where I've been at Indie Reads now for about 9 years, and it's something that I enjoy enormously. I'm still very involved in the arts world as well, but literacy and education and books and reading is something that is really what I'm most passionate about. I've been fortunate over the years to also be able to teach English a bit myself, both at the college level and English as a second language, and it's something that obviously I care deeply about, and so I'm very honored to be able to lead this organization, Indie Reads, and now to publish this book, Indie Writes Books, and I'm sure we'll talk about it a little bit later, but also we have a bookstore here in Indianapolis, Indie Reads Books, and it's great to be able to have that be a part of our organization as well.
So basically, literacy is in your DNA, all the ABCs,
you know,
and so forth.
I think it is. I really do think it is, yes.
Fantastic. Do you recall your first book reading experience?
You know, I do. At least the first book I remember reading cover to cover. I mean, I loved reading as a kid, and I remember learning how to read very young. And I believe I was about 7 or 8 the first time that I was able to pick up a book and a longer book, you know, and read it cover to cover. I remember doing that one afternoon on a Sunday afternoon at my parents' house, and it was a mystery written for kids called The Westing Game by Ellen Raskin. And, you know, I've gone back recently and reread it. It still holds up as a great book. I mean, it's really sort of written for, you know, 7, 8, 9-year-olds, but I've always been a big fan of mysteries as well. But that was the first time reading a book cover to cover in one sitting. Mm-hmm. And that left quite an impression on me.
Very interesting. What were some other favorite books that you enjoy while you were growing up?
You know, I as I said, I always loved mysteries. My mother is a huge mystery fan. She still reads 2 or 3 mysteries a week sometimes, it seems. And so I was always sort of, you know, picking up a bunch of her you know, hand-me-down mysteries. but I also, through high school, really, started enjoying, sort of more challenging books. I read a lot of plays. As I said, I was involved in theater. And so that was a big part of what I was reading. And then, and later on, I really discovered, authors that I've just fallen in love with, like, Hemingway or Fitzgerald. And then more recently, I like Jonathan Franzen a lot, and there's just so many great authors. But I still probably read, I would guess, a couple mysteries for every other book I read. And just over the Labor Day weekend, I was reading an old Agatha Christie mystery for fun, So that's always been a big part of what I love to read.
Very interesting. I remember growing up reading about the Hardy Boys, Nancy Drew, and so forth. It was quite interesting, and it intrigues the mind because then you want to be a part of the action, so to speak.
Absolutely. I think mysteries are actually a really great way to engage kids in reading because, essentially they're puzzles, and whether they're like the old Encyclopedia Brown puzzles or five-minute mysteries or a full novel, it's a way that the kids feel as though that they have some power over it because they're being asked to, not just read a story about, some other place or some other people, but actually to engage in solving it. And, that's, I think, why mysteries are still so, great today. I mean, I love other types of books as well, of course. But I think mysteries are especially great for getting kids excited about reading.
Interesting. You mentioned reading and so forth being a passion. When did it actually become a passion, reading and writing, that is?
Oh, gosh. I have a really hard time actually remembering when it wasn't for me. I mean, I was very, very fortunate that we always had books around the house, around my parents' house, around my grandparents' house. And, I can't remember a time where either I wasn't being read to or reading or being encouraged to write. And I guess, that's something that I think I probably took for granted as a kid, but now I see that that's certainly not the case, for many people growing up, and that certainly leads to the work that we do with Indie Reads. And one statistic that I've heard frequently is that for every sort of middle income household, that there's an estimated 9 books of an appropriate reading level for every child in that household. And that when you get into low income neighborhoods, that because so many low income families don't have any books in the house, that you'll see statistics like there'll be one book essentially in a neighborhood for every 200 kids, because a lot of these parents and families don't have books in the household at all. It's not part of what they're growing up with. And having books around really makes a difference. I mean, of course you want to be able to read to kids and be read to, but even just having physical books in a house have been shown to make a difference, because kids will pick them up. Kids are naturally curious, and they want to know, what's inside of that. And, if they see their mom or dad reading a book or a newspaper, they want to model that behavior. And those are really important things for a child to see. That's part of building, a literate family, a literate culture, is physically having books around, and for kids seeing those parents reading books. And as I said, I was very fortunate that I had, both of those experiences growing up. I mean, there wasn't a time where I don't remember seeing my mom with a mystery in hand, or my grandfather, reading a newspaper, or my dad reading one of his books. And, I wanted to do the same.
Were there outside influences in your literary life?
Oh, certainly. I mean, I've been very, very fortunate to have a number of great mentors over the years in different ways. I mentioned that I worked at a bookstore in college and graduate school, and the man who owned that bookstore, named Michael Svoboda, and the bookstore was called Svoboda's Books, and he was a great mentor to me. I'd known him from when I was much younger, and then started working for him when I turned about 20, I guess it was, and worked for him for a number of years. And and he was someone who really introduced me to a lot of books I wouldn't have known about otherwise, and authors, and when I say authors, I mean literally authors who came into the store who I wouldn't have, you know, had a chance to meet otherwise, and really encouraged sort of the broadening of my reading and thinking about books and education and such. And so, you know, he was certainly a big influence on me, as well as, you know, many other, as I said, been fortunate to have some great mentors over the years.
Fantastic. When did Indie Reads come into existence?
Well, so as I said a little bit earlier, I've been with the organization about 9 years, but Indie mm-hmm. Reads has actually been around sort of in one form or another really since the early 70s. It started out as a grassroots organization to help adults struggling with reading and writing, and mm-hmm. the original founders were essentially a group of women who were librarians who also went to church together and decided that they wanted to do something to help the adults that they were seeing who were struggling with reading, and that's where it began. And it survived sort of as that grassroots type of organization for a number of years, and then in the mid-80s it actually became a registered not-for-profit.
Mm-hmm.
And then for a number of years, it was part of our public library system here in Indianapolis, and it was paid for and run by the library, though it had its own sort of separate not-for-profit designation as a separate mm-hmm. organization. And then about not quite 10 years ago, the library system here was dealing with some financial issues, and they were trying to find ways to save money, and they recognized that Indie Reads was its own separate organization, and so they gave our board of directors at the time, so about a year, to really figure out how to become an independent organization, and the library was very generous and offered office space and all sorts of help, but said, you know, this is the time for you to, you know, sort of spin off on your own now. And
right.
It was at that point that we actually commissioned a study to really determine whether or not there was a need for the type of work we do here in Indianapolis and central Indiana, and whether it would be supported or not. And that study really showed us that, yes, that no one else was doing this type of work with helping adults who were struggling with reading and writing, and that there would be the support in the community for it if certain things were done. And part of that was hiring an executive director, and that was me. And so I was brought mm-hmm. in to sort of lead the organization into independence about 9 years ago. And it's been a really exciting journey ever since. I mean, when I first came to the organization, at the time we essentially really only had one other staff person, Tom mm-hmm. Miller, who's my director of programs, and he had been with the organization for a number of years and was really responsible for developing the training methods that we use for our volunteers and a lot of the curriculum that we use, and had really brought the program into, even though it wasn't very well known locally, amongst national literacy organizations, Indie Reads at that point was already known as being a very strong program and a model for other programs.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was really important for me that Tom stayed on. And when I first joined the organization and such, it was just the two of us and mm-hmm. our board of directors. And we had about maybe 350 or so students and about that many volunteers. And mm-hmm. since then, now we, if you include our bookstore and other things, we have a staff of about 18, and we work with about 1,500 students a year as opposed to 300, and we've grown quite a lot over the past 8-9 years that we're really proud of helping more people in our work. And Tom, our program director, is still here, and I'm still here, and we're still chugging along.
Fantastic. Wonderful success story.
We work pretty much just with adults. We are an adult literacy program. So when I say students, I'm referring to adults.
Okay.
So all of our students are 18 and over. Mm-hmm. And we have students right now between the ages of 18, and we have a couple students in their 80s right now.
Mm-hmm.
We do offer family literacy workshops, and those are a little bit different. It's not working directly with children, but it is working with families and with the parents. And mm-hmm. that's something that's become very important to us, to help parents who may be at risk for different reasons, whether maybe they struggle with reading and writing themselves, or Maybe they're a very young parent who maybe is going through parenting classes for different reasons and trying to really understand how to become a better parent or whatever it may be. And so we offer workshops that help these new young parents, at-risk parents, really understand why it's important to read to and with their kids, why it's important to have books around the house, and give them a lot of techniques to make reading more enjoyable for them and their kids. I think maybe the best example I can give you is that there was a young man in one of these classes, and he knew he was supposed to read to his young daughter every night, and he would get sort of a new book out of the library every day and just sort of speed through it. And after our class, we were talking about it, and I said, did you pick anything up? And he said, well, first off, I didn't know I could read the same book more than once. And for a lot of parents, of course, know that kids love having the same book reread to them over and over at night. And this guy didn't even know that was an option, and of course that made his life a little bit easier. But the other thing was, he would just sort of speed read through the book, wouldn't show the pictures to his daughter, wouldn't slow down, wouldn't let her follow along, and all of a sudden he realized that he could do that, and that also made it, a lot more beneficial for his daughter and a lot more enjoyable for him. And things like that may seem pretty basic to a lot of us, but that's kind of what we try to do in our family literacy workshops. Now, otherwise, what we do is we provide free one-on-one tutoring to adults who are struggling with reading and writing. We also do small group classes throughout the community. We do work in helping people who are learning English as a new language, as well as people who are native English speakers. We do a lot of work with community centers and jails and reentry programs. And we also do a lot of work that's tied to people who are trying to get their high school equivalency degree and maybe go back to get that degree and enroll in those classes and aren't really reading well enough to be able to get that degree. And so we provide a lot of assistance to those classes as well. And that's the core of our basic work that we do through the nonprofit, is providing those, as I said, about 1,500 adult students this year with that type of training and help, whether it's that they want to be able to get a better job or just read a bus schedule or understand their prescriptions better or maybe be able to cook from a recipe. There's a lot of different reasons why adult students come to us for help and a lot of different ways that we provide that help.
That's a very impressive list of mission that you guys are currently working on. Does a parent literacy level accurately predict a child's future academic and economic success?
It really does, and I'm glad you asked that, because it's quite interesting. In fact, there's been some studies that have shown that, especially for the mother, that it's much more important that the mom knows how to read and has a high school degree or has a college degree, and that those factors are significantly more important than whether or not the mom is from a low-income family or a wealthy family or not. When you take all that out, the mom's reading ability and education level is the greatest predictor of whether or not her child is going to graduate from high school. And that right there is that step. I mean, you can get a child to read well enough to read at grade level and graduate from high school and get to that point, then you've given them the skills that they need to be able to succeed. But with a lot of our students, they never read at grade level, and that's why very few of them were able to graduate from high school, and it's extremely difficult to succeed in any way if you're not able to read in our society. And so certainly both the parents make a big difference, but a lot of it really does come to the mom's education level and ability to read that outweighs almost anything else in terms of predicting a child's future success.
Very interesting. How successful have you guys been with regards to the adult literacy program?
Well, we look at both what it is that our students want and want to achieve, what their own goals are. And then we also look at, you know, are they really improving their reading levels by working with us? And our students, as part of their intake process, we really try to understand what their goals are. And you know, I mentioned a few, like, you know, getting a better job, reading a bus schedule. It may be registering to vote. It may be helping their own kids with their homework. It, getting a driver's license. There's, you know, a lot of different things. And we want to make sure that we're always working to help the student achieve what they want. But as we're doing that, we're also measuring, you know, is the student actually improving in their in their reading level? And what we see is that about half of our students improve their reading level by one grade level if they're with us about a year. And and that may seem like, you know, a long time, but, you know, if you think back, you know, it takes a year to go through first grade, a year to go through second grade, and you know, whether you're a kid or an adult, you know, to improve your reading level by one grade level often takes about a year. And that can be a little discouraging for some adult students who, you know, maybe they want to get their GED, their high school equivalency, and they need to be reading about an eighth grade level to do that, and they come to us and maybe they're reading about a third, fourth grade level. And it may take them a couple years to do that. But we see, you know, as I said, about 50% of our students improve their reading by one grade level. About 25% of our students will, though, improve their reading level by 2 to 5 levels within a year. And it's often those students who, it wasn't so much that they didn't learn how to read maybe when they were in school. It's just they haven't done it in so long that they kind of lost the skill. And they haven't practiced in so long, and so once they start doing it again, they're sort of able to, you know, reawaken that ability, and that's quite exciting when you see that. And then about 25% of our students, you know, they come to us and they may have severe learning disabilities or other issues that that are preventing them from being really able to read. And those students where we're not going to be able to show a whole lot of improvement of grade level, those are the ones we really work on the basic life skills. You know, what is it that they need to make their life better? You know, is it you know, really understanding a bus schedule or a map? Is it, you know, being able to, you know, put together a shopping list or cook from a recipe or, you know, measure out measurements, which can be very confusing. You know, tablespoons and teaspoons are can get awfully tricky, you know, for a lot of our students. And so we really try to focus on those basic life skills for those students. And that's really how I, you know.
I'm sorry. You're talking about functional literacy.
It really is that. It is that. And I'm glad you put it that way because, you know, Johnny, our students aren't necessarily coming to us saying that they want to, you know, read Moby Dick. You know, they come to us because they are looking at improving their reading for survival. This is about, you know, being able to make sure they get on that right bus or make that appointment or understand that they're supposed to give their child, you know, one pill every 4 hours and not 4 pills every 1 hour. You know, it's stuff like that that is very much about functional literacy. What's great is that often, you know, once they get past that, then they do start, you know, reading, you know, stories and books and, you know, we see a lot of our students who do develop a great love of reading as well, but that's not usually why they come to us.
It seems like you guys were able to present yourself to these students as a wonderful helping center where they don't feel discouraged or embarrassed to reach out and come on in and ask for your assistance.
Well, we certainly hope so. I mean, that's our goal because it can be very, very difficult for someone to admit that they're struggling with reading and writing. It can be very embarrassing, you know, and we certainly have had students who have come to us who have asked that we not, you know, call them at home. And we've had students who have come to us who have certainly been able to hide it from their employer for a while. In some cases, we've even had students who've come to us who have been able to successfully either hide it from their spouse or their kids. At one point, I remember hearing a story of a woman who used to come wearing a wig all the time because she didn't want to be, you know, recognized and such.
Yeah.
So, you know, it can be very difficult. But that being said, we really do We really do try to make sure that, you know, everything we do is very welcoming and very supportive. And, you know, we recognize that a lot of our students that, you know, literacy is not the only issue they're dealing with. They're, you know,
sure,
they may be dealing with issues of, you know, struggling to pull together the money to pay for a bus fare to get here. And, you know, when we can,
right,
we are able to, you know, give them bus passes. Or,
mm-hmm,
you know, they may be struggling with, you know, a lot of other issues that that go beyond that. And so we try to, provide assistance and help with those services as well when we can, or refer them to other organizations.
Sure.
But it's you know, we've got a lot of great staff and volunteers who really, really care about these people very much and want to help them as best as they can.
Wonderful. What is the inspiration behind Indy Writes Books?
Sure. So, you know, we've been talking about Indy Reads, which is the not-for-profit organization here. And as I mentioned a little bit earlier, one of the things that we do as part of this adult literacy organization is we also opened up a bookstore, Indy Reads Books. And we opened that store up about 3 years ago. And this is a bookstore for everyone. It's not just for adult
mm-hmm.
literacy
mm-hmm.
students. It's a general bookstore like any other bookstore anywhere else, you know. It's, you know, used books and new books, books for all ages. And we opened, and the book that we published, Indy Writes Books, is very, very much tied to the bookstore. Because
mm-hmm.
we opened up this bookstore because we were seeing that there really weren't any other bookstores in downtown Indianapolis. There are very few independent bookstores in our area. And we wanted to be able to promote literacy, not just in the work that we do with our adult students, but promote literacy for the whole community. And we also saw it as an opportunity to, what we were hoping to is to raise a little bit of money for our program as well, as a
mm-hmm.
as a way to generate income. Because as a not-for-profit, we rely on donations for all the work that we do. We don't get any direct support from the state or federal government or the city really in any way. It's all private donations. And so we were trying to come, you know, we came up with this idea of opening up Indy Reads Books. And what makes the store really exciting and unique is that it's located in sort of a very popular, hip arts and cultural area of downtown Indianapolis called the Mass Ave District. And it's right on this great path we have called the Cultural Trail that connects a lot of the different arts organizations and artsy neighborhoods and restaurants and such. So and a lot of people use it to bike and walk on. We're right on that. And it's a unique store because it is tied to a not-for-profit. So we do have some paid staff at the store who help manage it, but we also have about 50 people who volunteer at the store on a regular basis who really staff the store. And in terms of the used books, all of our used books are donated. And right now, Johnny, we get about almost 1,000 used books donated almost every day to the store. And it's amazing. And, you know, volunteers clean those books up, and some are sold through the store. Many are given away to other not-for-profit and education programs around the city and passed on to whether it be schools or jails or what have you. And so we've really become sort of a center for people to donate books. And then we also, as I said, you know, sell new books as well.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, when you have, you know, the majority of your staff volunteering their time and the majority of your stock being donated, it makes it a little bit easier to survive as a bookstore, which is, you know, it's bookstores are a tough business right now.
Right.
And so this is a model that, you know, I actually really think that a lot of when we first opened the store, we weren't aware of really any other not-for-profit bookstore in the country. And since then, I've become very aware of about more than a dozen of them and that have opened up in the past few years, tied different causes, some with children's literacy, some with adult literacy, some with other causes as well. And, you know, because it is such a difficult business, the bookstore business, I do think the not-for-profit model makes a lot of sense. And anyway, one thing that we're really fortunate with our store is that we have a nice stage space, and we have events there on quite a regular basis. In fact, on average, the past couple of years, we've had over 250 events a year, and so sometimes three, four, five events in a given week. And Many of those, not all of them, but many of them are author events where we have authors, local authors, regional authors, new authors, undiscovered authors, best-selling authors, mm-hmm. you know, come in and read from their books and do book signings and such. Mm-hmm. And I was sitting there, and we also offer other things, some workshops and some concerts and lectures and stuff, but mainly it's author events. And I was sitting there during one of them a few years back, and a woman named Kathy Day, who's a great writer, both fiction and nonfiction, and teaches at Ball State University here in Indiana, was reading this really lovely piece that was sort of comparing how when people used to leave calling cards, you know, 100 years ago, when they would come visit and you know, leave their calling card in a bowl by the door, and sometimes people would visit, sometimes they wouldn't, but sort of how the calling card is in many ways analogous to, you know, liking someone's status on Facebook today and how many friends you have and that sort of thing, like sort of a public way to show who you're connected to. And it was such a great, funny piece. I thought, boy, you know, it'd be awesome to publish that. And, you know, I was looking at all these other great authors that were coming in and out of the store and supporting us, and I started thinking about this history of bookstores being publishers as well, and whether that be like Shakespeare and Company in New York, in Paris, who had published mm-hmm. James Joyce, you know, many years ago, or the bookstore City Lights in San Francisco that mm-hmm. published Howl and other books, and looking at that and thinking, you know, what if we took this on to try to, you know, put together a collection of all authors who have been supportive of this bookstore, Indie Reads Books. Mm-hmm. And that's really where the first thought came from is, you know, I'd like to put together a collection anthology of authors who've read here at the bookstore. And then as we started working on and started really thinking about, like, what would this look like and what would it take, that was when I started thinking of sort of a theme that we wanted it to be a collection of stories, not just by Indiana authors or authors who had been at the bookstore, but authors writing about their love of books and bookstores and reading and literature and such in some way. And whether that be an essay or a short story or a poem or something else altogether, mm-hmm. that it would somehow in some way celebrate books and bookstores and reading and literacy. And that's really the theme of this book it's called Indie Writes Books. Its subtitle is A Book Lover's Anthology. And we really wanted it to be that sort of celebration that anybody who's a real book lover would be able to mm-hmm. pick this up and find something in here. And there's, you know, 29 or so, you know, different authors that are represented in this book, and so many different styles and so many different types of work, but that anyone would be able to find something that would appeal to them and connect to them about, you know, their love of books and reading. And that was sort of the initial inspiration for this piece.
Fantastic. I know I enjoyed it very much, and you guys have a whole slew of writers that are very, very impressive. Some of them nationally known as best-selling authors. So please share mm-hmm. with us the contribution of this national best-selling authors to the book.
Well, we're extremely proud to have John Green in here. And, of course, many, many people know John Green, the young adult writer, mm-hmm. whose books have recently been turned into movies, The Fault in Our Stars and Paper Towns, and as well as his other books, Looking for Alaska and such. And John is, you know, it's so exciting what John is doing, because he has really, I think, developed this whole new generation of young mm-hmm. readers who are so excited about reading and so excited about talking about books. And there's something really magical about John. And what's fortunate is that he lives here in Indianapolis. And mm-hmm. Because of that, you know, I've gotten to know him over the years, and he has mm-hmm. been just a great, great supporter of our bookstore. And in fact, he was the first author that ever read at the store when we had our opening. And, you know, and at that event, and that was before any of the movies came out, and it was just from the power of his books alone that we had literally hundreds and hundreds of teenagers show up, some from Indianapolis, some from out of state, that you know, lined up at this, you know, this new bookstore that we were opening just so they could, you know, hear this guy read and talk. And it was, you know, it was, you know, like, a, you know, kids lining up to see a rock star, and except they were very well behaved, you know, and that's just such an amazing thing. And so, you know, when we first started, you know, talking about this, and we, I mean, you know, my staff and board of directors and such, and we're talking about, you know, how would this work out, and you know, immediately everyone, of course, you know, knew that we had to have John Green in here, that that we wanted to be able to include him, and you know, because he's certainly the best known Indiana author currently. And and so I contacted John, and it was when John was working on the movie The Fault in Our Stars, and he was really, really crazy busy. But he was like, yes, absolutely, I want to be a part of this, I want to support you guys, you know, I love the work that you do, and such. And, you know, as I said, he's come to our bookstore a lot, he's come to many of our events, and he said, you know, what I'm going to do is, I've got these three pieces about reading and writing that had been essays he had written at one point for Chicago Public Radio, but had not been published anywhere. And so he gave them to us to include in the book, which was great. And it made a huge difference, not just, you know, I think, you know, I'm sure some people will pick this book up because they know John Green's in here, but it also made a difference for us as we were contacting other authors. And you know, and I made a point of, I wanted to include authors who had, you know, whether they lived in Indianapolis or Indiana or had some other connection, that there was some connection there, and that they had in some way been supportive of our bookstore. And I wanted to get a, you know, really good wide variety of authors. And so I started, you know, calling different authors who I know and asking them if they would be interested. And, you know, and pretty much with all of them, you know, as soon as I said, well, you know, John Green's going to be in the book, and they're like, oh yeah, I want to be in it then. You know, I'll donate something, because, you know, all of them wanted to be, you know, in a book that John Green was going to be in. And that's, you know, fun. That's great. It's good for them. And, you know, one of the authors, a guy named Ben Winters, who, is just such a talented young guy. I really like his work. He was just starting to get some recognition for this trilogy that he wrote called The Last Policeman when we went to Ben. And that's gone on to become a New York Times bestseller trilogy. He's done some other books as well. His work is kind of a cross between science fiction and mystery. You know, and he wrote just a great fun piece, an original piece for this book, and we're really glad to include that. I mentioned Kathy Day, the author who sort of, you know, her one essay sort of started it all, and Kathy's written a lot about some great fiction about Indiana, as well as some great nonfiction about her love of football and such, and she's got a story in here that it's sort of a funny, tongue-in-cheek sort of piece about getting published. And I'll tell you that all the other authors in this book have told me that that's their favorite piece in the book, because it rings so true for all of them about the struggles of getting published and such. But, you know, then we've got such a fun other variety of things. I was really happy to be able to include Jeff Kinnerk and David Hoyt. They're the guys who create the Jumble cartoon that, you know, is in papers all around the country. And Jeff, who's the illustrator of the Jumble, lives, you know, here in town, and has been an amazing supporter of Indie Reads over the years. And I went to them and said, you know, we're doing this anthology of writers, and, you know, would you be interested in, and like, and they immediately said, yes, we want to create a Jumble, you know, a puzzle, an original Jumble just for your book. I'm like, great, you know, and that's kind of fun. And the piece they created, it's an illustration that sort of looks like our bookstore, which is cool. Was able to go to Will Shorts, who's the guy who's, you know, known for being the puzzle master on public radio and New York Times crossword editor. And Will is from Indiana. And he actually got his degree in puzzleology from Indiana University. And I've been able to meet him on a number of occasions. And, you know, and he'd said, you know, if there's something I can do to help your organization in the bookstore, let me know. And so I, you know, went to him and said, hey, could we have one of your puzzles? And he said, great, you know, and did that. And, you know, so that's kind of fun. But then we've got some great, great poets in here, and such a fun variety of work. I mean, there's a mystery by a guy named Terence Faraday, who's a great mystery writer, and then we've got a play by Lou Harry, who's both a playwright and author and journalist here in town, and you know, just a really, really fun mix of things. And we really hope that by putting together a mix like this, that you know, someone may pick this book up and say, "Oh, I really want to read, you know, a John Green story." Yeah. And but then they discover, you know, someone like Dan Wakefield, who's really, you know, sort of this legend of Indiana authors that you know, maybe a younger reader hadn't heard of Dan before, and so we're able to introduce them to Dan and his work. So that's really what we're hoping for with a book like this.
It's fascinating. I want to let you know that I listen to NPR broadcast on Sundays for the Whip Pump.
Mm-hmm. Me too. That's always fun. Yeah.
Were there challenges in putting the book together?
You know, it's. I was thinking about this. Mm-hmm. You know, sort of a question, idea, and challenges, and you know, other than the time it took, really there weren't. I mean, all the authors were so generous. Mm-hmm. In bringing the book together. And we were really fortunate. We were able to work with this great, you know, young kid named Zach Roth, who was part of Butler University's MFA writing program. And Zach helped to edit the book and really kind of organized all the stories in an order that, even though each one's very different, there's a nice sort of continuous flow through the whole book. Mm-hmm. And then I was able to work with Zach and then a designer woman named Amy McAdams on working on the physical design of the book. And that was one of the most enjoyable things, because what we did with this, Johnny, is I really wanted the book to be physically something people would remember or associate with good experiences with reading. And so I went through my own bookshelf and our bookshelves at the bookstore and started pulling out tons of books that my memory of reading them was not just the story itself, but maybe it was something about the cover or the smell or the texture of the pages or the font or whatever. That, you know, when I thought back about that book, I remembered more, you know, about it physically than I did other books. And so we started looking at, you know, what were those books and what did they feel like? And we tried to design a book that sort of encapsulated a lot of those things in terms of the weight of the paper, the font style itself, the fact that we went with a hardcover that doesn't have a dust jacket, that has a really interesting sort of texture on it. And all those elements were really important to us when we designed this book, so that it would physically be as much of a celebration of books as what the content was. And I tell you, what was really exciting for me is when we got the books back from the printer, and I was taking them to the different authors so that they could have, you know, their own copies of the book. And I met up with John Green, and he picked up the book, and he's like, "Whoa, this feels better than my books." Like, well, thanks, John. You know, and that was a great compliment, you know, because it's we think it's a pretty special book. It's a great gift for a book.
It is a beautiful book. It was very well done. I really like the simplicity of the design, the cover, and yet it's what I consider has so much meat.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Yeah, there's a nice simplicity to it, but there's also some really neat, subtle things going on in the book,
in its
design aspects, and that's something that we hope, you know, readers will appreciate.
Wonderful. Can you read for us the poem titled "Romancing the Book" by Lisa Hyatt?
Yeah, I would love to. She's just a great poet, and a very kind lady, and this is a really neat piece. It's called "Romancing the Book," and it starts out, "Lonely, a scrap of handwritten paper in a library book makes you long for connection to the body of another reader. And then you and an attractive stranger flirt in the stacks, searching for the same book. A week later, you meet at the library for a first date. At each other's place the first time, you check out the books in the bookcases on the kitchen table at the bedside, and you find love and own many of the same. You tell each other about learning to read, favorite first books, the books that freed you in high school and those that lit your path ever since. Falling in love, one with the cosmos, you quote the same poem again and again, except for the point, the still point, there would be no dance, and there is only the dance. You give and receive books as presents. You borrow each other's books, read each other's old favorites, wanting to go back in time and fall in love at every age. You move in together and neither complains. There are so many heavy boxes of books to load and unload from the U-Haul. So sure that it will last, you mingle your books on the shelves, two collections becoming one. You read together in bed, take turns reading aloud. You call just to share a poem. The glow fades and real marriage begins, but you remind each other about the still point and the dance. On vacations, you spend time in hard-to-find small bookstores and old libraries, browsing together for hours. Though you have your disagreements, when one of you urges, you should read this book, you still want to. And you are also glad you both read books that the other hasn't, because what is being read is like music. It fills your house, becomes part of the air you breathe. When one goes away on a long trip, you read the same book to stay connected. And yes, you repeat an old argument which won't be solved. But again and again you choose to stay, having read some truth that breaks through pain with balm for the heart. I think that's just such a great piece. And you know, I'm glad you asked me to read that one, because I certainly know I've moved my share of boxes of books and mingled books on shelves and such as all of us have.
It's fantastic. You know. It was just such a beautiful poem, and I thought it was extremely fitting for today. Actually, today you reminded me that today is International Literacy Day.
It is. It is. Yes, September 8th. This is a day recognized by UNESCO all over the world about the importance of literacy for children, for adults, for all of us, you know, in every country. And, yeah, it's really great to be able to chat with you on World Literacy Day, International Literacy Day, and talk about Indy Wright's books. And, you know, I do want to say one thing. I mean, you know, we created a book that we think is a great, great book here that people will really enjoy. They'll be able to be introduced to some new authors. They'll be able to, you know, read some great pieces about, you know, books and bookstores and their love of reading. But all the proceeds from the book also go directly back to supporting the Indy Reads Adult Literacy Program. So, you know, if someone buys a copy of Indy Wright's books, the proceeds are helping provide free tutoring for an adult here in Central Indiana who's struggling with reading and writing. So we're pretty happy about that too.
Wonderful. What would you really like for the readers to gain from reading this anthology?
You know, I guess there's two things. There's two things I would like them to gain. The first is that to find out about maybe some authors that they haven't heard of before, you know, and you know, like I said, I mean, you know, we all know John Green, but maybe you haven't heard of, you know, the poet Karen Kovacic, or you know, of the writer, you know, Larry Swayze, who writes mysteries and westerns and such, or John David Anderson, who's this great young adult author, and so my hope is that, you know, people will discover some authors that we, you know, here in Indiana are pretty proud of and think are great, and would like to share with the rest of the world. That's first and foremost, you know, to really celebrate these great authors. But secondly, and I guess perhaps really more importantly, is that we hope that, you know, through this book, more people are aware of the issues of adult illiteracy in their communities, not just, you know, here in Central Indiana, but, you know, almost every, you know, community across the country struggles with this. And there are great programs for adults in pretty much every community, sometimes through the libraries, some through other programs, to help adults who are struggling with reading and writing. And it is a significant issue for our country, and it really affects, you know, our economy, it affects our public safety, it affects our health in many ways. And it's something that I think a lot of people would be very surprised about to find out that really about 1 in 5 adults in our country struggle with reading and writing. And that doesn't mean they can't read and write entirely, but it does mean that they are probably reading at a very low level, probably read very slowly, probably have a really hard time comprehending what they're reading, and struggle with being able to write at all, and probably, you know, are relying on other people to, you know, fill out applications or do their banking or understand their prescriptions or things like that. And, you know, you can't be self-sufficient if you're struggling with reading and writing. So, you know, I hope that, you know, people, when they find out about this book, Indy Wright's books, as I said, first off, they find some great authors they haven't discovered before. But second, they really learn a little bit more about adult literacy and how adult illiteracy affects their community and our country.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Where can someone go to buy the book, get more information about you, and keep up with the latest happenings?
Sure. Thanks for asking. Yeah. We have, of course, a website for our bookstore and for the organization. The bookstore's website is indyreadsbooks.org, and that's all together, I-N-D-Y-R-E-A-D-S, books.org. And on our bookstore website, people can order directly the book Indy Writes Books and have it shipped to them. There's also a lot of great information on that website about all the events and all the things we do at the bookstore. There's also links on that Indy Reads Books website to the Indy Reads organization website, where we have more information about our programs and issues about adult literacy and illiteracy. But also, you know, right now people can, you can order the book Indy Writes Books through Amazon, or you know, ask your local bookstore if they can get it for you. We'd be happy to do it that way as well.
We have a caller.
Oh, good.
Who has a question for you, so I'm going to put him on the air, and this is from caller with the ending number of 4880. Go ahead, sir.
Hi there, my name is Hotep. Sounds like a very good book. I have two questions, one about technology and the other about the educational system. One is, do you think that about 10 or 20 years from now, our printed books will be basically obsolete and we will be totally digital, which will, of course, affect publishing rights, copyrights, and all that kind of stuff? And then the second is, do you think that adults that can't read, it's because of failures in our educational system, or is the onus on the adult to know how to read even though they don't know how to read?
Those are great questions, really great questions, and ones that I think about quite a lot. I'll start with the issue of technology and books. You know, I just heard a report that actually ebook sales dropped last year as physical book sales increased for the first time in a number of years, which I find very interesting. You know, I don't think that books are going to be entirely replaced. I think that there's something very special about physical books that people still really like a lot. It may not be that all books are published in a physical way. It seems to make a lot of sense for a lot of textbooks and other things to be electronic. And certainly it makes it less expensive to publish electronically. I think we're still trying to figure that out. You know, there's some things that I know personally. I don't mind, you know, reading on a computer or a phone, but you know, if I sit down with a novel or something, you know, I want a physical book, and I think we're definitely seeing that. I can't imagine that it would be something that would be entirely replaced. I think it'll be supplemented, and I think we'll discover new ways of how we share reading and writing. And you know, and just to add one thing here, you know, people ask me, you know, oh, or would you be against ebooks? I'm like, no, as long as people are reading,
right?
I don't care how they're reading, you know, and whatever method is great. You know, we chose to publish Indy Writes Books as a physical book to celebrate, you know, sort of books as well. And obviously, you know, we have a bookstore that has physical books in it. But as long as people are reading, you know, it doesn't, you know, in the end really matter to me how they get to that point. Now, as far as our students go, I think that's a great question as far as, you know, were they failed? And I will say that I think in many cases, and possibly most, I would say yes. What we see is that a lot of our students suffer from dyslexia or some other learning disability, and that when they were in school, their school did not have the resources to be able to help them. And when that child started falling behind in reading and staying up with reading at grade level, they weren't given the attention, they weren't given that extra instruction that they really needed to stay up with it. And what happens is, you know, once you fall back in reading, you start falling back in all your other subjects as well. And you get to a point where, you know, it's just a lot easier to drop out. Now, I'm not saying that's the case for every one of our students. We certainly have some students who come to us who dropped out because of maybe there were issues involving an unexpected pregnancy, or that someone needed to leave home to work, or, you know, issues of substance abuse. I mean, that certainly comes up at times. You know, and I think with those students, what's most important to remember is, look, they're choosing to take control of their lives now. They want to be self-sufficient now, and we want to provide them that help. But I will say that those cases are more rare than the ones who you know, I think we're failed by our education system, that they did not get the help they needed when they were in school, and they dropped out, and now they're trying to do something about it. But it's a real shame. I think it's incredibly disappointing that we continue to have, you know, such high high school dropout rates, and the fact that so many of our students in elementary and junior and high school aren't reading at grade level. That's really where it starts, and you got to make sure that kids read at grade level first, or everything else just sort of falls apart from there.
Right. So true. What advice do you have for someone who is seeking help to improve their literacy skills?
You know, I think the biggest thing is that they recognize that they do need some help, and that they look into what programs are available, whether it's through their library or local literacy organization, you know, and that they go into it with a willingness to learn, and that, you know, there's nothing shameful about it at all. And I'll tell you, I mean, you know, as I said, I mean, some students come to us and all of a sudden they're reading so much better than they were before. And it may be an issue of even things like they never had prescription glasses before and didn't realize they had a vision issue, you know, or I mean, it can be things as easy as that. And other times, you know, they didn't realize they were dyslexic or whatever it may be. And it doesn't mean that it's always going to be easy, because it can take a lot of work. But there are a lot of organizations out there and a lot of people who want to help. And, you know, being able to read allows self-sufficiency that you just can't have otherwise. And it really improves the individual's life and the family's life in so many ways. So it's such an important thing.
So true. What is next for you and Indy Reads?
Well, gosh, you know, we're always looking at what's next, and I hope to be able to publish another book sometime soon. Right now, we're doing a really exciting program with the Indianapolis Museum of Art. An artist by the name of Richard Wentworth is designing a big installation. He's known for creating these installations of books that are hanging from the ceiling in different ways, and we're actually collecting books and sourcing books to work with him and creating that exhibition that's going to open at the end of September at the Indianapolis Museum of Art and be up there for a while. And we're really excited to be a part of that.
Fantastic. We're coming close to the end of the hour. Since our show is about people, family, and living life, would you like to share a recipe for living with our listeners this morning?
You know, I was thinking a lot about that, Johnny. And I guess for me, it really comes down to everything is a choice, and how we react to things and how we look at the world is a choice. And that was something that my grandfather always shared with me, you know, that attitude is a choice. But, you know, whether we look at something as an adventure or an inconvenience, you know, that's our choice to make. And for me, my recipe for living is to, you know, recognize that I do always have a choice in how I approach, you know, any situation. At least, you know, maybe I can't choose the situation, but I can choose how I approach and think about it.
That's fantastic. Well, Travis, thank you for the wonderful recipe for living and for spending this hour with me on From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. To all our listeners, please join me next Tuesday morning. My guest will be Marie Georgopoulos. She is an intuitive counselor, healer, and spiritual mentor. Marie will be hosting and conducting her biweekly Meditation for Moms series and talked about her worldwide consciousness movement, Meditation for Moms. For additional information about this show and future shows, please go to fmmktalkradio.com. Thank you for listening and have a blessed week. Travis, it has been a wonderful pleasure. Thank you again and have a blessed day, sir.
Thank you, Johnny, very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.